The following program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. You may have noticed that one Whole Foods Market store is not like the other. We're proud that each of our stores has its own quirks, a direct connection to the surrounding community, and buys and sells their own products. Whether it's artisanal chocolates exclusive to Bowery, small batch pickles in Chelsea, or a featured craft beer on tap at West 97th, you'll find that each store is a little bit different than the next. With six Manhattan locations, Whole Foods Market offers a taste of every neighborhood. Come see us in Tribeca, Bowery, Union Square, Chelsea, Columbus Circle, or the Upper West Side. Open 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. For more information, visit www.wholefoodsmarket.com.
Yes, this is Burning Down the House at HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I am Curtis B. Wayne, your host, for your weekly fix of everything related to design, architecture, and the creative arts. This week, brought to you by Whole Foods. In the world of green design, that is to say, not painting it green, but green, that is ecological, to take an old term, ecologically sensitive design. One of the more recent and interesting for me trends has been this thing called passive house. It's a German concept, so if you do some research, you'll find it more quickly if you spell it in the German way, P-A-S-S-I-V-H-A-U-S. And it's a creation of a German physicist, I believe, a Dr. Feist. And what's different between designing a structure, mostly housing, to be a passive house, from that construct of using the United States Green Building Council's LEED system, L-E-E-D, is that a passive house attempts to be a net zero user of energy. Because we know, for example, that people give off about 1,100 BTUs per hour just going around. Lighting that we have, artificial lighting, gives off heat energy. Cooking, computers, televisions, consumer electronics, all of the energy that's electrical inside our house becomes converted into heat energy to a lesser or greater degree according to its efficiency. And so the concept is that it should be possible through careful use of technology, and ideally, I think, low technology. That is to say, not like the International Space Station or a space shuttle, but using natural systems of ventilation and lots of insulation and careful siting of a residence that is using the sun and the wind and the weather to our advantage to have a comfortable place to live, that a house can use no energy. Now, what are the benefits? Well, one of the benefits is that the people who occupy it don't have utility bills. And boy, oh boy, if you've been unhappy about your utility bills we can, in the short term, only expect them to skyrocket. What with these days, all of the unrest in the Middle East, and with oil going through $100 a barrel just this week, it peaked at $104 for crude oil, because most of our electrical power comes right now in the United States from fossil fuel generated plants. We can expect our utility bills to just really get rather extreme. So the idea of having a place to live where our utility costs are very low is very attractive. Joining us in studio this week is an architect who spent considerable time thinking about this, Ryan Enchity, architect from Brooklyn. Say hello.
Hi, Curtis. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, nice for you to come in. Now, Ryan found us just through word of mouth here in New York. One of the people that I used to work with at Perkins Eastman is a neighbor, and word got around, and Ryan contacted us, and we've had him on as a call-in guest before, and now he's finally made it all the way here to 261 Moore Street, to the Garden of Roberta's restaurant, where we have Heritage Radio Network. So, Ryan has...
And I've enjoyed listening to the show, I would add.
Well, thank you so much. Keep it up. We love being flattered.
Yes.
And, yeah... I do appreciate that.
Well, it's actually the truth.
Well, thank you. And today, most of what we're going to talk about is house-oriented. I know that a lot of our colleagues have diversified beyond just the single residence house here in the city. Most of all of our housing is multi-unit housing. But the American icon really remains the single-family residence on a plot of land. And there are good lessons to be learned, whether it's a house sitting somewhere in the desolate prairie of Minnesota, where there are one or two passive houses that have been built already, or applying these concepts to multifamily development here in Brooklyn. Let's have a little house music with our first musical break. Thank you. Welcome back, Burning Down the House, talking about Passive House with Ryan Enchity. Brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Curtis B. Wayne, architect, and your host. I stand corrected. Passive House is not a net zero house. That's somebody else's scheme, is it? Tell us.
Well, it depends on... It doesn't depend. You want to come back to that? I know you have a plan in mind for the show.
Well, am I correct that Dr. Feist is a physicist?
You are correct. Yes,
all right, that's good. We like physics, speaking as a former physicist. I love that, you know, the reality of at least traditional physics dealing with the real materiality of things. So, we'll get to Dr. Feist. Let's just jump right in with a passive house is not a net zero house.
What a passive house is it's a house certified by the Passive House
Institute. Oh, no, more certifications.
Yes.
And certified by?
By the Passive House Institute.
Uh-huh. Otherwise known in Germany. Known as PHI.
Well, that's right. And in this country, PHIUS.
Uh-huh. PHIUS. PHI in Germany.
U.S.
And PHI U.S. All right.
So, and it's a certification that's focused very narrowly compared to LEED, for example, or other green building rating systems.
Uh-huh.
It's focused entirely on operating energy used.
Operating energy used. Right? Wow. That's getting real close to Henry Gifford's beef with the USGBC.
It is. Yeah. Yes. It's.
Do you know Henry? Have you met him?
I have. I've listened to a couple of his presentations. I have not met him personally.
Actually, met him. Well, he's around.
You've had him on the show, no doubt.
Yeah, he's been here. Yes, I take no point of view, officially or unofficially, about the merits or wisdom of his lawsuit, but I do wish that we at least see some success in loosening up the information that he seeks. I think that would be very good to see how LEED buildings actually have performed.
I would agree.
And but that's the
LEED.
That's the idea of Passive House, is to monitor its actual energy use, not necessarily net zero.
Well, Passive House does not actually have a monitoring requirement either.
Really?
But the houses have been prototyped
and tested,
built and followed up with,
yeah,
pretty extensively. So one of the primary tools in designing a house that you have to use is the PHPP software, which is really just a gigantic Excel spreadsheet, and that is vetted.
Do you have to pay for that?
You do.
Oh, shit. That's too bad. I hate stuff.
It's not expensive.
It's like you have to sign up and you have to pay money. And who supports PHI? Is it self-supporting like USGBC?
I couldn't give you the complete answer to that question.
Okay. How long has it been around?
Well, it came out of Dr. Feist's interest in developing the most energy-efficient way, the most cost-effective way to build the most energy-efficient, this is if I understand correctly, but I had the chance to put this question to him directly. And his indication, what he told me was that this was developed first and foremost as a way to build the most energy-efficient house for the least money.
Wow.
And what they went back to, and this
Who could not salute that, right?
Indeed.
Go ahead.
And this effort began, if I understand correctly, in the early 90s, after I think perhaps the Rio Summit, or at some point in about that time.
Which Rio Summit?
The Earth Summit, if I understand correctly. I'm not a Passive House history expert by any stretch here.
All right.
But the...
Well, I'm not either.
Right. But I'd like to get the facts right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That
differentiates us from people who just, you know, assert things without having done any research. We don't want to go there. Because we're architects, we'd like to have a little bit of factual backing.
Just enough to give us...
Some credence. Yeah, absolutely. Credibility is important.
So he picked up on a building methodology that was actually started in this country and in Canada in the late 70s after the oil embargo.
Yeah.
And called the low-cal house, the super insulated, it's also referred to.
Right.
And it's a little different than the passive solar houses that also started to develop at that time.
Sure.
Period.
We remember those from the whole Earth catalog era.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is a slightly different idea. And the idea is to invest an unusually large effort in the building envelope, in your container, and to make that container as great as you can.
in terms of being insulative?
Well, insulation, so the thermal resistance of the envelope.
Yeah.
The air infiltration also, because air infiltration, all the, believe it or not, and you know this, but I think it's a surprise to many people to discover that the hidden cracks in the within the construction of your building's walls and roofs allow a large quantity of air to come in and go out of the building.
Sure. And back when we counted on that infiltration as part of our ventilation calculation.
Today, I would suggest.
Well, even today, the building code requires a certain amount of operable sash so that you can open the window to let fresh air in. 10% of the floor area of a habitable room has to have glazing, and half of that, or 5% of the square footage of the room, has to be represented by an operable open window for fresh air. Pretty crude, but at least there is some legal recognition of the need for fresh air. So that was a good thing. So
so this was technology that was developed initially in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Feist, and I believe in collaboration with Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, picked up on this, and as you also no doubt are aware, this sort of stuff has petered out in this country. But in the throughout the 80s, it declined and has been...
You mean earth-savvy awareness and...
interest. I would say interest in energy efficiency.
Well, but then it peaked again, or picked up again with the USGBC somewhat, although the LEED system is not just about energy efficiency. It's about all kinds of other things, too.
Well, larger trends aside, let me focus then.
Well, it's true that it's true. In my own experience, energy efficiency, after the shock of the... lack of being able to get gasoline in the 1970s, and then the next shock, which is about 6 years ago, when gasoline hit $4 a gallon, those energy efficiency waves die out, and people turn the thermostat up to 75 in the winter and turn it down to 70 in the summer, and it's like, okay, I can handle my utility bill. And in between these shocks, people kind of fall asleep. They go away. So, more to the point, what makes the system of determining whether we've got a passive house or not different or similar to the USGBC LEED system? Is it a matter of
passive house is, as I said, it is solely it solely addresses the operating energy use. So LEED, for example, as you also I'm sure know, tries to be comprehensive. It tries to you something for it every.
Okay, it gives you points for being local. It gives you points
it
for
tries
being
to address
renewable.
Every aspect in which a building has an environmental impact.
Right.
From city planning, neighborhood planning, down to material choices, to water use, to energy.
So a passive house is not a matter of, and this is one of the criticisms that are brought up with LEED, which is a checklist. It's not a matter of checking off 1, 2, 3, 4. It's really more looking at the systems relate to efficiency.
It is a 4-point checklist.
Wow.
And those points are really hard to hit.
1, 2, 3, 4. Jack, could you play the next song, please?
Long nights as when my youth was four. Old teenage hopes arrived at your door. Left you in the deep, but they want some more. Oh, you're changing your heart. Oh, apart. Cozy and cold, put the horse before the cart. Those teenage hopes who have tears in their eyes, too scared to run off to one little lie. Oh, 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 the change in his heart. Oh, 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 you know who you are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10. Money can't buy you back the love that you had then.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Burning Down the House with Ryan Enchity, a green architect of Brooklyn, who's complaining to me I'm putting him through his paces. That's what we do here. Let's talk.
I prepared for this show.
Good, good, good.
And you're not letting me follow my preparation.
I never let anybody follow their preparation, but I know that you're prepared to have to talk about...
I think it's important to get
all
this
of these
right.
aspects.
So you asked we I well I segued right into 1, 2, 3, 4 there.
Yes,
shall
you
we
did.
Shall I
very well done.
So it's the PHI's opinion, and I would agree, and I'd love to come back to maybe why this is true, I think. But
what's true?
That energy is the overarching operating energy used is really the first step to address in making buildings quote-unquote sustainable. And I can come back to that if you like.
Well, I don't know that anyone would ever disagree with that unless or until somebody invents room temperature fusion power,
well,
you know?
I think it's not my own anecdotal experience with clients, other architects, friends, family, is that I think there's not an understanding of how important that is. There's a lot of, as an architect working on a job, I'm sure your experience probably matches mine in that there's a lot of attention put into things that aren't energy related, and I would argue that I think it's hard to argue otherwise that over the last since the 1920s, earlier, our building technology, with regards to energy use, has essentially not changed. That since the advent of mechanical conditioning, we have gone on hold.
We've been on an energy binge.
And you know, as a designer, and I know that you are, no matter what you design, energy is cheap. You can just throw more mechanical conditioning at it. And in fact, your client, if you spent too much of their budget on silly energy efficiency stuff, would actually have a kick your butt, right? And contractors are the same. The contractor knows that they're going to be held to what the paint finish looks like.
Yeah.
And that wall, when it's closed up, is done. So I think we're working with...
Well, it all depends. Now, things are changing because we, as a body of knowledge, we architects, and I make a distinction between architects and mere designers, so I think that's an important thing because
I've listened to the show.
We've invested a lot of effort to become architects.
It's true.
And it's a very demanding mistress, this practice. We architects are struggling to educate people that the choices that we make when we put together their houses are very important beyond just what it looks like and how it works. Is really important. Frank Lloyd Wright understood that in terms of integrating lighting and ventilation.
And Frank Lloyd Wright was someone who was of an era that was predated mechanical conditioning.
That's right.
And
people were comfortable in
all
his
the
houses.
Early moderns, Corbusier,
yeah,
and Pryor. Since
sure.
then,
that's Le Corbusier, which is Charles-Edouard Jean-Régris, the probably third most famous architect of the 20th century. I'd say that Wright was the most famous architect of the 20th century. Mies is probably second, and Corbeau is probably third, tied with Aalto, you know? But that's just architect talk. Those of you who are civilians, you can look those people up and learn a little bit about the architectural legacy that we struggle with every day in our architectural practice. But comfort, I mean, I think it's easy to sell comfort, and I think it's increasingly easy to sell the idea that it's going to cost you practically nothing to live here.
I think that you can add to the altruistic argument for something like Passive House with all sorts of supporting, here's what you're also going to get arguments, like it's a more comfortable building, it has better air in it, contrary to sort of the image that some people have developed. It's going to be quieter.
It's not going to have the sick house syndrome because it's not just super sealed and super insulated.
It's super ventilated.
Yeah.
And
in different ways.
And the ventilation is accomplished via a little piece of equipment that captures that heat from the outgoing air and returns it to the fresh incoming air.
Mm-hmm.
But the primary goal is altruistic, and it's attempting to be altruistic in the most...
I don't like that word. I prefer humanistic.
Humanistic, well...
Be altruistic, but I think our goal is to make life easier for the people who live in these residences that we're creating.
The
benefits will exceed the lifespan of the original people who commissioned
these.
That's
true.
For hundreds of years, people will be able to have a place to live that is practically, once it's paid for, if they can afford their property taxes, a free ride in terms of the cost of living.
The power goes out, these buildings
will
still be relatively warm.
Yeah. And they'll still be cool in the summertime.
And they are, to me there is an altruistic component that has to be.
That should be the way that everything should
be? I just think that you have to accept that as part of the reason to do this. I mean, it goes to this, right? I have a graph here.
Let me see that.
The carbon. This is the graph that everyone's seen, global carbon going through the roof.
Yeah.
And if you believe that that is a problem, then, perhaps you don't. But if you do, I think that there's an altruistic component.
I don't know anybody who's not insane who doesn't agree that carbon in the atmosphere.
Have you asked? You might be surprised. I discovered just recently a couple of people that are. I know at least two.
Well, carbon.
Believe in global warming.
The discussion about carbon is two aspects. One is air quality. Two is global temperature.
I'm focused on what am confident is going to be the impact of global temperature change.
Well, I think that's a different conversation than talking about a house by house thing, because there.
I disagree.
I don't think that we can have a conversation without getting someone who's a specialist in solar activity involved here also.
Why is that? That seems...
Because the sun is going through a 50-year phase of excessive solar flare activity, which started in the 1970s. How do I know about that? I used to be involved in amateur radio, and the ionosphere started going totally batshit around 1977. And a physicist wrote into Popular Electronics saying, boys, at that time it was still a bit misogynist, you're going to have trouble with radio communications for the next 45 to 50 years because of the sun. We can set that aside. There is absolutely every reason to want to keep carbon out of the atmosphere because it just makes things worse. If, as it is believed, the sun is throwing out a whole lot more solar energy than we had previously seen for quite some time, the last thing we want is to have a greenhouse effect and trap that solar energy more increasingly over the way that it had been previously. However, we have to get buy-in from the emerging industrial powers in order to really rein this in.
I would disagree, and I have another chart, Curtis.
Wait for China.
No, look.
Wait for China. How do you know that the data?
I'm giving Curtis.
I'm looking at the global
per capita CO2 emissions,
and I'm looking at China,
which is very
which
small.
Is like no tons per cubic,
and the U.S.
It's because our data reporting is really good. And here you've got Greenland being pink, being like a high... Oh, that's per capita.
Per capita.
Okay, well, so the Inuit actually have to burn wood to stay warm, and there's not very many of them.
You're looking at Alaska. I think that that's probably average.
I'm looking at Greenland here. We can put up some of these. Have you posted these to your personal blog?
Well, this is from... It's from
Well, you've got a blog, right? Or you got a website?
I have a website.
Well, you should put these up on there. Invite comments. I'd say a lot of this has to do with the people who want to report. Brazil's not even on this map, and we know they're burning down the rain, chopping it down and burning it down at quite a rate. And it's not even on this picture.
That's because it's, well, what do you
They're
mean?
They're just not reporting.
Possibly.
All right, we're getting away from Passive House.
I think I would disagree, because this is the reason for doing Passive House to me. You can make a comfort argument for it, absolutely.
I have every intention of making a comfort argument.
And it would be a valid argument, but...
Because if you can't start with... our own individual clients' comfort, then we may as well become politicians. I mean, grassroots means one commission at a time, building awareness from below, well, right? I mean, it's all well and good for the G5 to determine that they're going to do cap and trade of carbon credits and to have a Kyoto agreement, which either we do or we don't. I forget if we presently are or we weren't. I know we weren't previously a signatory to that. That's all well and good on a political basis, but we as architects, we as builders, if it's a grassroots effort, which I believe it is, then what's wrong with the comfort of the dozen or two houses that we might design over the next 20 years.
Well, it's what's also, I find, compelling about the Passive House standard is it's meant to be an economically very doable thing.
Sure.
Right? So it...
It's, yeah, sure. The insulative factor here could be taken care of with which you sent me an email saying, "Oh, don't do high density expanded polystyrene."
XPS.
Yes, don't use XPS. Use something else. Well, there are other reasons to use XPS, but I don't want to get into the arcana of that. But we can use shredded blue jeans. We can use other plant materials. We can use cellulose. We could use corn husks. We can use all sorts of materials as insulators, as our ancestors before us have. Right? Now, have you used...
Cellulose is a fantastic insulation. And
I understand shredded blue jeans are pretty good, too.
I have used shredded blue jeans. I would argue for the superiority of a blown-in product, because...
It fills voids.
It fills all the voids.
Right.
And you know that a bat product gets stuffed and cut and squished.
Oh,
and
yeah. It has all kinds of gaps.
Has all kinds of
bats. Little... That's B-A-T-T, not the little squeaky mammals that fly around. That's sure. The roll after roll of fiberglass that's stuffed into stud walls
never
is
gets
imperfect.
Stuffed perfectly.
No, of course not.
It's impossible to stuff perfectly.
Of course, if you have to go into a wall that has blown in insulation afterwards to mess around with something that's in there, it's a little bit messy.
That's
but,
true.
And getting the insulation back where it belongs, that's a little messy. But
that's true.
Not as bad as if it was expanding polyurethane insulation or something like that.
Well, I'm going to still argue that the reason for doing passive house
is for global warming.
Is because you're concerned about global warming and you're concerned about humanity's impact on the environment.
I think that's a really hard sell.
Well,
I think comfort is a really easy sell.
Maybe, tell you what.
In terms of, look,
well,
in terms
of... We will tag team your prospective client.
Well,
you can hit him.
See.
You'll hit him with all the good cop stuff, right? You'll
I'm
hit him with all the like...
Ryan, I'm not in a position to be selling. I'm a senior technical guy. People, I'm working now at Cook Plus Fox Architects, and I'm the senior technical guru. Other people pitch it. I figure out how we're going to build it.
Yes.
So to me, although I have opinions, they come to me with, this is the design intent, and I tell them, or we work together to figure out how these things are going to get built in a responsible kind of way. But I think the comfort aspect is real easy to sell.
Yes.
Because I think that...
As is payback.
I think that everybody wants their house to be...
Quiet.
The kind of...
with fresh air.
Jack, cue up the next song, if you please, to be like this.
You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play your love songs all night long. So hard. Now everything is easy 'cause of you. And la 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 la.
place the flowers in the vase that you bought today.
And that, my friends, I think is what our clients want from us as architects. They want comfort. I think that's an easy sell. This is Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, brought to you by Whole Foods here on the, what is today's date? 6th of March.
I don't know.
2011, with Ryan Enchity, a green architect from Brooklyn. And we're debating
what our clients want.
Yeah. No, I think we're debating what we should be emphasizing in terms of why we are making decisions on their behalf, whether it's good for the planet or good for them to have
if you have a
warm
client,
and comfortable home.
What if you have a client that comes to you and says, I am concerned about global warming, then what?
I'd encourage them to probably stop eating meat. I know that's absolute blasphemy here at Heritage Radio Network, which is an arm of Heritage Foods USA, which is a meat dealer, but the production of meat, like the production of building products, which is something I want to talk about.
Is energy intensive. Look at that graph. Not to hit you with another graph.
Give me that graph. Let me look at that.
Almost.
We're 50. Looking at a little pie chart here.
Three pieces to that pie.
Industry, CO2 emissions, which
industry
is a
transportation
squirrely thing,
and buildings.
According to
meat, would fall under industry.
Yeah, that's about 20%.
And look at
buildings are about 50%, and transportation is all the rest. This is according to
that's U.S. federal government data.
Yeah, put together by
Architecture
2030.
The effort
who's that?
Ed Masria. It's an excellent website and an excellent endeavor.
Ed Masria.
Ed Masria was one of the early passive solar promoters, builders, practitioners in the Southwest who closed his practice because he felt that this was what he needed to be doing.
Well, CO2 notwithstanding, because not all energy releases CO2 into the atmosphere. France gets 40% of their power through nukes. We get about 20% from nukes in the future. Yeah. When we run out of oil, it will all either be nuclear fission or fusion, if somebody gets a handle on that, or solar, which includes wind, because wind only blows because of solar energy. So,
I would argue
you think that pressing the global warming buttons is going to appeal to somebody. I think selling them that they're going to have a warm and comfortable house.
I think you're probably right, but I think if you don't have a client that wants to reduce global warming, you don't need to sell them a passive house.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everybody would like to know that their utility bills can be amortized.
That's true.
I mean, you get a mortgage. Amortization of the current federal tax code for a house is 27 years.
That's true.
Mortgage is 30 years. You spend a fraction more for a passive house in terms of your first cost, and you skew that against unknowns.
That's
a known monthly cost against unknown utility bills in the future.
That's true. Here's an interesting factoid.
Real easy.
Along those lines.
Yeah.
When I took the training, the classes were taught by the director of FIAS,
yes.
Katrine Klingenberg, who is the founder of the brought the movement to this country. She, I believe, if I recall correctly, expressed that Shell Oil has been interested in passive house.
Not BP, huh?
As an investment in the energy future of this country. As an investment.
to invest in Passive House.
Well,
Royal Dutch Shell. Cool. Very cool.
Curtis is checking his email as we talk.
I'm looking for the picture of Katrine and Dr. Feist.
So should we, what do you say we go back to what, how it is that one builds a building like this?
Well, I would like to, I mean, I guess you don't have the data, but that's okay.
Which data?
This is a conversation I had just the other day about the inherent energy cost of materials. Case in point was photovoltaic arrays. With our current technology, the amount of energy that is required to mine the rare earth materials to go into PV cells.
I think there's a valid argument there.
Transport them, refine them, manufacture the photovoltaics, and then truck them again to the end site. So
when you do a life cycle analysis,
if you want to look at the energy cost, the global energy cost of creating that photovoltaic array that you would like to put on the roof of your house to offset your grid-related utility costs, the PV array, photovoltaic, has a life cycle of about 25 years before it just stops working or doesn't work efficiently. The amount of energy that it creates through normal solar load.
They estimate a longer lifespan, do they not, for those things?
We don't have a lot of experience upon which to base our analysis of what the life cycle of a PV array is. Because large-scale PV arrays only have existed in space with NASA on spaceships. I mean, it's spaceship technology. Anyway, the idea is that the amount of electrical energy that is created in your house when you buy this PV array, put it up, and it is offloading the amount of electricity you're getting from Con Ed or someplace like that. For the first 7 to 10 years, you're still in the hole in terms of energy benefit on a global basis with current technology.
I have not seen a life cycle analysis for solar panels, but I think that that's probably a, my guess would be that that's a valid point. And that it's also true of many other things that, like your XPS, when you look into it
right.
a little bit more carefully.
Well,
XPS, for example, has an order of magnitude.
Takes a lot of energy, but XPS as an insulation is very useful for a couple of other reasons that are not necessarily related to heat transference. One of the reasons that I like multiple layers of XPS is that it is virtually impermeable to water vapor. So we can, if we install it properly, and we have several layers of XPS insulation in a nice thick roof, say stress skin construction, we can get a. We don't need the vapor and water barriers because we've got insulation that also is a huge barrier to water and vapor. So we've saved a little bit of money on, you know, the cling wrappy stuff that otherwise would be doing that. Also, it has horizontal and compressive strengths that are very useful in a roof structure. In a wall structure, that's not so important because we've got other materials that take the transverse wind loads, the shear loads in a wood frame stud wall. But in a roof, having roof insulation that's not going to just shred or fall apart as would blow in cellulose be in a roof cavity is a very interesting and useful thing. If, as in a recent case for me, you have a client who wants to see exposed roof structure, he wants this client wanted to see exposed rafters, and of course then with that came exposed tie joists and things like that because they wanted this project to look like a barn. Well, then we have the energy code. Then I took it beyond the energy code because insulation is cheap. So in that case, I used XPS because I didn't want the roof, which suddenly became rather thick, to shear from the horizontal force of wind. I didn't want to just rely on the very long stainless steel screws that were holding the top layer of that stress skin thing down to the sheathing that was actually attached to the rafters. So I had a reason to do that. XPS is a lot better in shear than polyiso, which you mentioned, which is good. It's better. It has less in terms of
global warming potential
of carbon dioxide release. It's true. But something that we build and we build right should be good. I say should, if it's not torn down because people are boneheaded and they just want new for the sake of new, should be good for at least 150 years.
But
without major renovation.
What? But we're here to talk about Passive House. Yes.
Yeah, we got off of it.
Where do you want to go next?
I wanted to just talk a little bit about the passive solar thing that seems to have fallen by the wayside back in the day, as they say. We used to like passive masonry. You know, we liked the idea of masonry and some layers of glass over masonry so as to be able to trap passive solar heat, because we happen to be Yankee architects, and our concern was more about being really cold in the winter, because there are other ways of cooling a house through natural convection and flue action in a house. So there was a lot of talk about the long-term benefits, even though masonry, especially brick, takes a lot of energy to create a brick house. I mean, it's really built, and it's good for a long, long time. Let's have our last musical break, Jack, if you please. Didn't get to the pre-rap stuff. That was the Commodore, Brick House. Brick House was like the passive solar expression of the late 1970s. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about before we go out was that, I've observed this, and perhaps you have also, Ryan, is that our architectural design ideations have not changed in step with this new approach to technology. Frank Gehry's structure is envisioned as a thin shell structure, infinitely thin planes that are warped and bent. Zaha Hadid's designs are very similar in that way. For those of you who are architects, passive house seems to suggest that we would beget houses that look more like Corbusier's Ronchamp Chapel with very thick walls, because that's the technical solution to having a super thermally isolated house. So we have a design crisis here where we're still thinking in terms of a 2x4 stud wall.
I would offer in support of that our contemporary building construction has not changed in a century.
No, it hasn't. Absolutely.
And that we are, especially here in New York, where our buildings are old, but really across the country, everywhere, we're driving Model Ts and using chamber pots with our buildings.
Well, even...
And that because energy has been cheap, we have gotten that aspect of tech of our culture's technology has not been developed the way that things like iPhones have. And what Passive House does is it begins to bring the way we build our buildings, in particular with energy efficiency and comfort also, and cost also, into the 21st century. It begins. And that, as you pointed out, those things drive the... You have to...
We as architects need to start educating our clients that...
And each other.
That's why we're here talking about this.
Maybe we should come...
Two or three... talk again.
Yeah,
absolutely. This is just, you know, the tip of the iceberg. Educating our clients that there are aspects of social responsibility. And this is one of my own feelings, is that we as architects have an implied social contract. Because we are licensed by the state in a way that mere designers are not.
And our clients trust us.
We have enormous influence. Not only responsibility, but also authority. And in New York City, you or I, as an architect, can stamp and seal a drawing saying, I certify that this meets the building code. And they say, okay, you bet. Well, there's practically no other profession that has that kind of power to say, it is so because I say so. With that comes an implied social contract that we have to do the right thing by society, by the planet, by our future generations.
By our children.
Our children's children and other people's children's children. And part of that now becomes that we need to raise a level of discourse that the construction of enclosing walls, just for example, need to be more than just one thin layer. The new building at One Bryant Park has got three layers of glass, and there's a energy trapping system in that, although it's a glass building.
And I would offer the criticism that it's the same on all four sides, and that is right there a problem.
Well,
that's another conversation, perhaps.
You come to the studio, you can argue with Rick and Bob about that. I'm sure I'll lose. There are always reasons why some system is repeated on various sides of a building. Yes, the north is different from the south, and the east and the west are different, and we have the climate reasons.
I worked for Bob Fox for a little while.
Well, that's good. He's a great guy. So is Rick. There are many, many aspects and reasons why we differentiate the different orientations. I mean, and if we want to get into Hindu architecture, there's the whole world of Vastu architecture, where the south is not good, but the north is. If we want to get into feng shui, then the south is good, but the north is not so good. I'm just talking about plain old passive house and North American comfort. And amen to that. Well, this has been part one of talking about Passive House. Here on Heritage Radio Network, this has been Burning Down the House for 6th of March 2011, brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Keep the faith. Speak with you again soon.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Foods USA. In late March, Dan, Andrea, Patrick, and the Heritage team are traveling to the coldest reaches of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont to help the Cantor family tap sugar maple trees. Then the maple sap will flow down to the sugar house, where it is boiled gently over a wood fire just as it has been for generations. Just a few days later, this grade A amber syrup will be poured into the beautiful glass jugs and sent to you for pancakes, waffles, desserts, glazing hams, or just drinking by the spoonful. There's only a limited supply, so order today. Each 1-liter bottle is $45, including delivery. Delivery will be at the end of March, and we will notify you of the exact shipping date. Each shipment will include a CD explaining the whole process. You can also follow us on YouTube while we work and bottle. In the meantime, you can head over to the Heritage Radio Network archives and listen to Linda Palacio talk about maple syrup on her show, A Taste of the Past, Episode 12. For more information, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join wine impresarios Aaron Fitzpatrick and Brian DeMarco as they dish out on the latest industry news with winemakers and tastemakers on Heritage Radio Network's revamped wine show, Unfiltered. Erin Fitzpatrick, one of the first hosts on HRN with her program At the Root of It, amps up the volume and unfiltered content with co-host Brian DeMarco in this 2011 Redux. True to the original format, Erin and Brian will keep you abreast of current happenings and break down the news and global events, distilling complex into anecdotal stories that inspire. From media and political events to hailstorms in Argentina, no topic is out of bounds. Tune in every week to hear them chat up the industry's biggest personalities and host on-air tastings with visiting vintners and the country's hottest sommeliers. Whether you're an expert or an enthusiast, Unfiltered demystifies wine and lets you know what it really takes to get a bottle from the vineyard to your neighborhood wine shop. Unfiltered broadcasts live every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Omofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.